I guess hoping something would shake loose. I think our guy, something tells me it won't be long before there's another.
I know what you mean. That's why I was so hyped about this Foothill thing. Damn it! Why are there no other cases out there?
That's the question. Bosch heard the call waiting click on his phone. He checked the screen and saw that it was the number Whitney Vance had given him.
Hey, I got a call, he said. Let's talk tomorrow about next moves.
You got it, Harry, Lourdes said. Bosch switched over to the other call. Mr. Vance? There was no answer, only silence. Mr. Vance, are you there? Silence. Bosch pushed the phone hard against his ear and put the window back up. He thought he might be able to hear breathing. He wondered if it was Vance, and if he was unable to talk because of the health issue Sloane had mentioned. Mr. Vance, is that you? Bosch waited, but heard nothing, and then the call was disconnected. Chapter 13. Bosch made his way over to the 405 freeway and headed south through the valley and over the Sepulveda Pass. It took him an hour to get down to LAX, where he slowly followed the loop on the departures level and parked in the last garage. He grabbed a flashlight from the glove box and then got out and quickly moved around the car, crouching down to point the light into the wheel wells and under the bumpers in the gas tank. But he knew that if his car had been tagged with a GPS tracker, the likelihood of him finding it would be very low. Advances in tracking technology had made the devices smaller and easier to hide. His plan was to go online and buy a GPS jammer, but it would take a few days to get it. Meantime, he went into the car to return the flashlight to the glove box and gathered the birth certificates into a backpack he kept on the floor. He then locked the car and took the pedestrian overpass to the United Airlines terminal, where he rode an escalator down to the arrivals level. Circling around a baggage carousel that was surrounded by travelers fresh off a flight, he moved in and out of the crowd and went out the double doors to the pickup zone. He crossed the pickup lanes to the rental car island and jumped on the first shuttle he saw, a yellow bus destined for the Hertz rental counters on Airport Boulevard. He asked the driver if they had cars available, and the driver gave him the thumbs up. The Cherokee that Bosch left in the parking garage was 22 years old. At the Hertz counter, he was offered the option of trying out a brand new Cherokee, and he took it despite the surcharge. 90 minutes after leaving San Fernando, he was back on the 405, heading north in a car that could not have been tagged by anyone hoping to follow him or keep GPS tabs on where he was going. Just the same, he checked the mirrors repeatedly to be sure. When he got up to Westwood, he exited the freeway on Wilshire Boulevard and made his way into Los Angeles National Cemetery. It was 114 acres of graves containing soldiers from every war, every campaign, from the Civil War to Afghanistan. Thousands of white marble stones in perfect rows standing as a testament to the military precision and waste of war. Bosch had to use the Find a Grave screen in the Bob Hope Memorial Chapel to locate the spot where Dominic Santanello was buried on the North Campus. But soon he stood in front of it, looking down at the perfect green grass and listening to the constant hiss of a nearby freeway as the sun turned the sky in the west pink. Somehow, in little more than 24 hours, he had built a feeling of kinship with this soldier he had never met or known. They had both been on that boat in the South China Sea, and there was the fact that Bosch alone knew the secret history and tragedy heaped upon tragedy of the dead man's short life. After a while, he pulled out his phone and took a photo of the marker. It would be part of the report he would eventually give Whitney Vance, if the old man was able to receive it. While the phone was still in his hand, it buzzed with a new call. The screen showed a number with an 805 area code, and Bosch knew that was Ventura County. He took the call.
This is Harry Bosch.
Hello, this is Olivia McDonald. You posted a message on my brother's memorial page. You wanted to talk to me?
Bosch nodded, noting that she had already answered one question. Dominic Santanello was her brother.
Thank you for calling so quickly, Olivia, Bosch said. At the moment, I'm actually standing at Nick's grave in Westwood, at the Veterans Cemetery.
Really? She said. I don't understand. What is going on?
I need to speak to you. Could we meet? I could come to you.
Well, I guess so. I mean, wait a minute. No, not until you tell me what this is about.
Bosch thought for a long moment before responding. He didn't want to lie to her, but he couldn't reveal his true purpose. Not yet. He was bound by confidentiality and the sheer complication of the story. She hadn't blocked her number. He knew he could find her, even if she told him to pound sand and hung up on him. But the connection he felt with Dominic Santinello extended to his sister. He didn't want to hurt or haunt this woman, who at the moment was no more than a voice on the phone. He decided to take a shot in the dark. Nick knew he was adopted, right? He said. There was a long silence before she answered.
Yes, he knew, Olivia said.
Did he ever wonder where he came from? Bosch asked. Who his father was? His mother?
He knew his mother's name, Olivia said. Viviana. She was named after a church. But that was all our adoptive parents knew. He never pursued it past that.
Bosch closed his eyes for a moment. It was another piece of confirmation. It told him that since Olivia had been adopted too, she might understand the need to know. I know more, he said. I'm a detective, and I know the whole story. There was another long pause before Olivia spoke.
Okay, she said. When do you want to meet?
Chapter 14.
Bosch started Thursday morning shopping online. He studied an array of GPS detectors and jammers, and chose a combo device that did both. It cost him $200, with 2 days shipping. He next went to the phone to call an NCIS investigator at National Personnel Records Center in St. Louis, Missouri. He had Gary McIntyre's name and number on a list of contacts he took with him when he left the LAPD. McIntyre was a cooperative straight shooter that Bosch had worked with on at least 3 prior cases as a homicide investigator. He was now hoping to trade on that experience and mutual trust to obtain a copy of Dominic Santinello's service package, the file containing all records of his military service, ranging from his training history to the location of every base he was ever stationed at, medals he was awarded, his leave and disciplinary history, and the summary report on his death in combat. The military records archive was routinely on the checklist of cold case investigation because of how frequently military service played a part in people's lives. It was a good way to fill in details on victims, suspects, and witnesses. In this case, Bosch already knew the military angle regarding Santinello, but he would be able to layer it with a deeper history. His investigation was essentially at an end, and he was now looking to put a full report together for Whitney Vance, as well as possibly find a way to make a DNA confirmation that Dominic Santinello was his son. If nothing else, Bosch prided himself on being thorough and complete in his work. The files were made available to family members and their representatives, but Bosch was not in a position to reveal he was working for Whitney Vance. He could play the law enforcement card, but didn't want that blowing back on him should McIntyre check to see if his request was part of an official investigation by the SFPD. So instead he was up front with McIntyre. He said he was calling about a case he had as a private investigator where he was trying to confirm Santinello as the son of a client whose name he could not reveal. He told McIntyre that he had a meeting later with Santinello's adoptive sister and he might be able to swing a permission letter from her if needed. McIntyre told Bosch not to sweat it. He appreciated the honesty and would trust him. He said he needed a day or two to track down the file in question and then make a digital copy of it. He promised to make return contact when he was ready to send, and Bosch could have until then to come up with a family permission letter. Bosch thanked him and said he looked forward to his call. Bosch's appointment with Olivia McDonald was not until 1 p.m., so he had the rest of the morning to review case notes and prepare. One thing he was already charged about was that the address she had given him for her home matched the address listed for the parents of Dominic Santinello on his birth certificate. This meant she was living in the home where her adopted brother had grown up. It might be a long shot, but it put the chances of finding a DNA source into the realm of possibility. Vosh then made a call to defense attorney Mickey Haller, his half-brother, to ask if he had a referral for a private lab that would be quick, discreet, and reliable in making a DNA comparison, should he come up with a source. Up until this point, Vosh had only worked DNA cases as a cop, and had used his department's lab and resources to get comparisons done.
"I've got a couple I use, both fast and reliable," Haller said.
"Let me guess, Madeline finally figured out she's too smart to have been your kid? Now you're scrambling to prove she is?"
"Funny," Vosh said.
"Well then, is it for a case? A private case?"
"Something like that. I can't talk about it, but I do have you to thank for it. The client wanted me because of that bit of business last year in West Hollywood."
The case that Whitney Vance had referenced during the interview involved a Beverly Hills plastic surgeon and a couple of corrupt LAPD cops. It had ended badly for them in West Hollywood, but it had begun with Bosch working on a case for Haller.
"And it sounds like I'm due a commission on any funds you collect on this thing, Harry," Haller said.
"Doesn't sound like that to me," Bosch said. "But if you hook me up with a DNA lab, there might be something in it for you down the line."
"I'll send you an email, Brohane."
"Thanks, Brohane." Bosch left the house at 11:30, so he would have time to grab something to eat on his way to Oxnard. Out on the street, he checked in all directions for surveillance, before hiking a block up to the spot where he had parked the rented Cherokee. He ate tacos at Paquito Mas at the bottom of the hill, and then jumped on to the 101 and followed it west across the valley and into Ventura County. Oxnard was the biggest city in Ventura County. Its unattractive name was that of a sugar beet farmer who built a processing plant in the settlement in the late 19th century. The city totally surrounded Port Hueneme, where there was a small U.S. Navy base. One of the questions Bosch planned to ask Olivia McDonald was whether proximity to the base was what lured her brother into enlisting in the Navy. Traffic was reasonable, and Bosch got to Oxnard early. He used the time to drive around the port and then along Hollywood Beach, a strip of homes on the Pacific side of the port, where the streets were named La Brea and Sunset and Los Feliz, after the well-known boulevards of Tinseltown. He pulled up in front of Olivia McDonald's house right on time. It was an older, middle-class neighborhood of neatly kept California bungalows. She was waiting for Bosch in a chair on the front porch. He guessed that they were both about the same age, and he could see that, like her adoptive brother, it was likely she had both white and Latina origins. She had hair that was white as snow, and she was dressed in faded jeans and a white blouse.
"Hello, I'm Harry Bosch," he said.
He reached his hand down to her, and she shook it.
"Olivia," she said. "Please, have a seat."
Bosch sat in a wicker chair across a small glass-topped table from her. There was a pitcher of iced tea and two glasses on the table, and he accepted her offer of a glass, just to be cordial. He saw a manila envelope on the table that had "Do Not Bend" handwritten on it, and assume it contained photos.
"So," she said, after pouring two glasses, "do you want to know about my brother? My first question is, who is it you work for?"
Bosch knew it would begin this way. He also knew that how he answered this question would determine how much cooperation and information he would get from her.
"Well, Olivia, that's the awkward part," he said. "I was hired by a man who wanted to find out if he had had a child back in 1951, but part of the deal was that I had to agree to the strictest confidence and not reveal who my employer was to anyone until he released me from that promise. So I'm sort of caught in the middle here. It's a catch-22 thing. I can't tell you who hired me until I can confirm that your brother was his son. You don't want to talk to me until I tell you who hired me."
"Well, how will you confirm it?" she said, waving a hand helplessly. "Nicky's been dead since 1970. Bosch sensed an opening. "There are ways. This is the house where he grew up, isn't it?"
"How do you know that?"
"The same address is on his birth certificate, the one that was filed after he was adopted. There might be something here I can use. Was his bedroom left intact?"
"What? No, that's weird.
Besides, I raised three kids in this house after I moved back. We didn't have room to turn his bedroom into a museum. Nicky's stuff, what's left of it, it's up in the attic."
"What sort of stuff?"
"Oh, I don't know, his war stuff, the things he sent back, and then what they sent back after he got killed. My parents kept it all, and after I moved in here,
I shoved it all up there. I wasn't interested in it, but my mother made me promise not to throw it away. Bosch nodded. He had to find a way to get up into the attic.
Are your parents alive? He asked.
My father died 25 years ago. My mother's alive, but she doesn't know what day it is or who she is anymore. She's at a facility where they take good care of her. It's just me here now, divorced, kids grown, and out on their own.
Bosch had gotten her talking without her coming back to her demand to know who his employer was.
He knew he had to keep that going and drive the conversation back around to the attic and what was up there.
So you said on the phone that your brother knew he was adopted.
Yes, he did, she said.
We both did.
Were you also born at St. Helens?
She nodded.
I came first, she said. My adoptive parents were white, and I obviously was brown. It was very white out here back then, and they thought it would be good for me to have a sibling who was the same. So they went back to St. Helens and got Dominic.
You said your brother knew his birth mother's name, Viviana. How did he know that?
That was usually kept from everybody, at least back then.
You're right, it was. I never knew my mother's name or what the story was there.
When Nicky was born, he was already set to go to my parents. They were waiting for him, but he was sick and the doctors wanted him to stay with his mother for a while and have her milk. It was something like that.
And so your parents met her?
Exactly. For a few days they visited and spent some time with her, I guess. Later on, when we were growing up, it was pretty obvious we didn't look like our two Italian-American parents, so we asked questions. They told us we were adopted, and the only thing they knew was that Nicky's mother was named Viviana, because they met her before she gave him up.
It didn't appear that Dominic and Olivia were told the full story about what had happened to Viviana, whether their adoptive parents knew it or not.
Do you know if your brother ever tried to find his mother and father when he was growing up?
Not that I know of. We knew what that place was, St. Helens. It's where babies were born that were unwanted. I never tried to find my naturals. I didn't care. I don't think Nicky did either.
Bosch noted a slight tone of bitterness in her voice. More than 60 years later, she clearly harbored an animosity toward the parents who gave her up. He knew it would not serve him here to tell her he didn't agree that all the babies were unwanted at St. Helens. Some mothers, maybe all of them back then, had no choice in the matter. He decided to move the conversation in a new direction. He took a drink of iced tea, complimented her on it, and then nodded at the envelope on the table.
Are those photos? He asked.
I thought you might want to see him, she said. There's also a story about him from the paper. She opened the envelope and passed Bosch a stack of photos and a folded newspaper clipping. They had all faded and yellowed over time. He looked at the clipping first, carefully unfolding it so it wouldn't split along the crease. It was impossible to determine what newspaper it had come from, but the contents of the story made it seem very local. The headline read, "Oxnard Athlete Killed in Vietnam," and the story confirmed much of what Bosch had already deduced. Santinella was killed when he and four Marines were returning from a mission in the Tainan province. The helicopter they were in was hit by sniper fire and crashed in a rice paddy. The story said Santinella was an all-round athlete who had played varsity football, basketball, and baseball at Oxnard High. The story quoted Santinella's mother as saying her son had been very proud to serve his country, despite the anti-war sentiment back at home at the time. Bosch refolded the clipping and handed it back to Olivia. He then took up the photos. They appeared to be in chronological order, showing Dominic as a boy growing into a teenager. There were shots of him at the beach, playing basketball, riding a bike. There was a photo of him in a baseball uniform, and another of him and a girl in formal wear. A family shot included him with his sister and adoptive parents. He studied Olivia as a young girl. She was pretty, and she and Dominic looked like real siblings. Their complexions, eyes, and hair color were a full match. The last photo in the stack showed Dominic in his navy dungarees, Dixie Cup sailor's cap tilted back, his hair high and tight with sidewalls. He was standing, with hands on hips, with a manicured green field behind him. It didn't look like Vietnam to Bosch, and the smile was the kind of careless, naive expression worn by someone who had not yet gotten his first taste of war. Bosch guessed it was from basic training. I love that photo, Olivia said. It's so Nick. Where did he go for basic, Bosch asked.
San Diego area. Hospital Corps school at Balboa, then combat training, and the field medical school at Pendleton.
Did you ever go down there and see him?
Only one time, when we went down for his graduation from hospital school. That was the last time I ever saw him.
Bosch glanced down at the photo. He noticed something and looked closer. The shirt Santanella wore was very wrinkled from being hand-washed and wrung out, so it was difficult to read. But the name stenciled on the shirt over the pocket looked like it said Lewis, not Santanella.
The name on the shirt is Lewis.
Yeah, that's why he's smiling like that.
He switched shirts with a friend of his named Lewis, who couldn't pass a swim test. They all wore the same thing. They all had the same haircut. The only way to tell them apart was the name stenciled on the shirts, and that's all the training people checked off when they did testing. So Lewis didn't know how to swim, and Nicky went over to the pool wearing his shirt. He got checked in under his name and took the test for him.
She laughed. Bosch nodded and smiled. A typical military service story, right down to the guy in the Navy who didn't know how to swim.
So what made Dominic enlist, he asked.
And why the Navy? Why did he want to be a corpsman?
The smile left on her face from the Lewis story disappeared.
Oh my God, he made such a mistake, Olivia said. He was young and dumb, and he paid for it with his life.
She explained that her brother turned 18 in January of his senior year of high school. That made him old compared with his classmates. As was required then during the war, he presented himself to Selective Services for his pre-draft physical. 5 months later, when he graduated high school, he got his draft card and saw that he had been classified as 1A, meaning he was draft eligible and likely to go to Southeast Asia.
This was before the draft lottery, she said.
The way it worked was the older guys went first, and he was one of the older guys coming out of high school. He knew he was going to get drafted, it was just a matter of time. So he joined up so he would have a choice, and he went into the Navy. He'd had a summer job over by the base at Wainimi, and always liked the Navy guys who came in. He thought they were cool.
He wasn't going to college, he asked. It would have been a deferment, and the war was winding down by 69. Nixon was cutting back troops.
Olivia shook her head. No, no college. He was very smart, but he just didn't like school. He had no patience for it. He liked movies and sports and photography. I think he also wanted to figure things out a little bit. Our father sold refrigerators. There was no money for college.
Those last words, no money, echoed in Bosch's mind. If Whitney Vance had owned up to his responsibility and raised and paid for his child, then there would have been money, and his son wouldn't have gone anywhere near Vietnam. He tried to break away from such thoughts and concentrate on the interview.
He wanted to be a corpsman, a medic, he asked.
That's another story, Olivia said. When he enlisted, he got to choose which way he wanted to go. He was torn. There was something about him. He wanted to get close, but not that close, you know? There was a list of the different things you could do. And he told him he wanted to be a journalist, photographer, or a combat medic, because he thought it would get him to, you know, where the action was, but he wouldn't have to be killing people right and left.
Bosch had known many of the same type over there, guys who wanted to be in battle without having to be in battle. Most of the grunts were only 19 or 20 years old. It was a time to prove who you were, what you could do.
So they made him a corpsman and trained him for battle, Olivia said. His first assignment overseas was on the hospital ship, but that was just to get his feet wet. He was there for, like, 3 or 4 months, and then they put him with the Marines, and he was in combat. And, of course, he got shot down.
She finished the story in a matter-of-fact tone. It was almost 50 years old, and she had probably told it and thought about it 10,000 times. It was family history now, and the emotion had gone out of it.
So sad, she said then. He only had a couple of weeks left over there. He sent a letter saying he would be home by Christmas, but he didn't make it.
Her tone had turned somber, and Bosch thought maybe he had too quickly come to the conclusion that there was no longer an emotional burden on her. He took another drink of iced tea before asking the next question.
You mentioned that some of his stuff from over there was sent back. It's all up in the attic?
She nodded.
A couple of boxes. Nicky sent stuff home because he was about to get out. He was a short-timer, and then the Navy sent back his footlocker, too. My parents kept it all, and I put it up there. I didn't like looking at it, to tell you the truth. It was just a bad reminder.
Despite her feelings about her brother's war things, Bosch grew nervous with the excitement of possibility.
Olivia, he said, can I go up to the attic and look at his things?
She made a face like he had crossed some line with a question.
Why?
Bosch leaned forward across the table. He knew he needed to be sincere. He needed to get up into that attic. Because it might help me. I'm looking for something that might connect him to the man who hired me.
You mean like DNA and stuff that old?
It's possible, and it's because I was over there when I was your brother's age. As I said on the memorial site, I was even on the same hospital ship, maybe even at the same time he was. It will just help me to look at his things. Not just for the case, for me, too. She thought a moment before answering.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, she said. I'm not going up in that attic. The ladder's way too rickety, and I'd be scared I'd fall off. If you want to go up, you can, but it will be by yourself.
That's okay, Bosch said. Thank you, Olivia.
He finished his iced tea and stood up.
Chapter 15 Olivia had been right about the ladder. It was a fold-down job, attached to the pull-down attic door in the ceiling of the second-floor landing. Bosch was by no means a heavy man. Wiry was the description that favored him his entire life. But as he climbed the wooden ladder, it creaked under his weight, and he worried the hinges on the fold would give way and he would fall. Olivia stood by below and nervously watched him. Four steps up, he was able to reach and grab onto the framing in the ceiling and safely redistribute some of his weight.
There should be a pull string for the light up there, she said.
Bosch made it to the top without the ladder collapsing and swung his hand around in the dark until he captured the pull string. Once the light was on, he looked around to get his bearings. Olivia called up from below.
I haven't been up there in years, but I think his stuff was in the back right corner.
Bosch turned that way. It was still dark in the recesses of the attic. Out of his back pocket, he pulled the flashlight Olivia had armed him with. He pointed the light into the back right corner, where the roof sloped sharply down, and immediately saw the familiar shape of a military footlocker. He had to crouch to get to it, and he banged his head on one of the rafters. At that point, he lowered himself to a crawl until he reached the locker. There was a cardboard box on top of the locker. Bosch put the light on it and saw that it was the box Olivia had mentioned her brother sent home from Da Nang. Dominic Santinello was both the sender and addressee. The return address was 1st Medical Battalion, Da Nang. The tape was yellowed and peeling, but Bosch could tell the box had been opened and then later closed before being stored. He lifted it off the footlocker and put it to the side. The footlocker was a basic plywood box, painted grayish-green, and now faded to the point that the grain of the wood was readily visible. There was faded black stenciling across the top panel. Dominic Santinello, HM3. Bosch easily interpreted the coding. Only in the military would HM3 stand for Hospital Corpsman 3rd Class. This meant Santinello's actual rank was Petty Officer 3rd Class. He pulled latex gloves from his pocket and put them on before handling either box. There was a single unlocked hasp on the footlocker. Bosch opened it and shone the light onto its contents. An earthy smell immediately caught in Bosch's nose, and he had a momentary flash of the tunnels he had been in over there. The wooden box smelled like Vietnam.
Did you find it?
Olivia called from below. Bosch collected himself for a moment before answering.
Yeah, he called out. It's all here. I might be up here a while.
Okay, she called back. Let me know if you need anything. I'm going downstairs to the laundry for a minute. The footlocker was neatly packed with folded clothes on top. Bosch carefully lifted each piece out, examined it, and put it on top of the cardboard box he had set to the side. Bosch had served in the Army, But he knew that across the board of military services, when the belongings of a KIA were shipped home to a grieving family, they were sanitized first, in order not to embarrass or add to the grief. All magazines and books featuring nudity were removed, as well as any photos of Vietnamese or Filipino girls, any sort of drugs and paraphernalia, and any sort of personal journal that might have details of troop movements, mission tactics, or even war crimes. What was left to return were the clothes and some of the creature comforts. Bosch removed several sets of fatigues, both camo and green, as well as underwear and socks. At the bottom of the box were a stack of paperback novels, popular in the late 1960s, including a book that Bosch remembered had been in his own footlocker, Steppenwolf by Hermann Hesse. There was a full carton of Lucky Strikes, along with a Zippo lighter with a chevron on it, from the Subic Bay Naval Base in Alangapo, Philippines. There was a stack of letters with a rubber band that broke the moment Bosch tried to remove it. He looked through the envelopes. All the senders were family members, and the return address was the same, the home Bosch was in at the moment. Most of the letters were from Olivia. Bosch did not feel the need to intrude on these private communications. He assumed they were letters of encouragement, with his loved ones telling Dominic they were praying for his safe return from war. There was a zippered leather toiletry kit in the box, and Bosch carefully lifted it out. More than anything else, this is what he had come for. He unzipped it and spread it open, then put the light beam into it. The bag contained all the usual toiletries: razor, shaving powder, toothbrush, toothpaste, nail clippers, and a brush and comb. Bosch took nothing out of the bag because he wanted to leave that to the DNA lab to do. The contents were so old he feared he might lose a hair follicle or some microscopic piece of skin or blood by moving it. By holding the light at an angle, he could see hair in the bristles of the brush. Each was longer than an inch, and he guessed that once Santanello had gotten out into the boonies, he had let his hair grow out like a lot of guys did. He next put the light on an old-fashioned double-edged razor, which was held in the kit by a leather strap. It looked clean, but Bosch could only see one of its edges. He knew the DNA gold mine would be if there was blood on it. One slight nick with the razor could have left a microdot of blood, which would be all he'd need. Bosch had no idea whether after almost 50 years DNA could be extracted from hair or saliva dried on a toothbrush or even whiskers in a double-edged razor, but he knew that blood would work. In the LAPD's open unsolved unit, he had worked cases where dried blood, almost as old as this, had given up a solid DNA code. Maybe he'd get lucky with what he had in the kit. He would deliver it undisturbed to one of the labs suggested by Mickey Haller, as long as he could persuade Olivia to let him borrow it. After zipping the bag closed, Bosch put it on the wood floor to his right side. There he would gather everything he intended to ask Olivia for permission to take. He went back to the seemingly empty footlocker and used a light and his fingers to check for a false bottom. He knew from experience that some soldiers would take the bottom panel out of an unused footlocker and put it inside their own box, creating a secret layer under which they could hide drugs, unauthorized weapons, and Playboy magazines. There was no removable panel. Santanello had hidden nothing in his footlocker. Bosch thought the contents were notable for their lack of photos and for having no letters from people other than family. Bosch carefully repacked the footlocker and pulled the top over to close it. When he did so, the beam from the flashlight caught something. He studied the inside top of the box closely, and by holding the light at an oblique angle, he could see several lines of discoloration on the wood. He realized these were marks created by adhesive that had been left on the surface after tape had been removed. Santanello must have at one time taped things, most likely photographs, to the inside of his footlocker. It was not unusual. The inside of a footlocker was often used like the inside of a high school locker. Bosch recalled many soldiers who taped photos of girlfriends, wives, and children inside their boxes. Sometimes signs, sometimes drawings sent by their kids, and sometimes centerfolds. It was unknown whether Santanello had cleared these off or whether the Navy's KIA unit did so while sanitizing his belongings, but it made Bosch all the more interested and what was in the box Santinello had sent home. He now opened it up and put the light on its contents. The box apparently contained things that mattered most to Santinello, and that he wanted to make sure got to Oxnard as he drew close to completing his tour of duty. On top were two sets of folded civvies, non-uniform clothing that would have been unauthorized for Santinello to have in Vietnam. These included jeans, chinos, collared shirts, and black socks. Beneath the clothes were a pair of Converse sneakers and a pair of shiny black boots. Having civvies was unauthorized, but commonplace. It was no secret that wearing uniforms while traveling home after completing a tour of duty or while on leave in foreign cities could cause confrontations with civilians because of the unpopularity of the war around the world. But Bosch also knew that there was another purpose to having civilian clothes. In a one-year tour, a soldier was guaranteed a week's leave at 6 months and a standby leave at 9, where they waited on the possibility of an open seat on a departing plane. There were 5 official leave destinations, and none were in mainland USA, because returning to the mainland was not authorized. But a soldier who had civvies could change in a hotel room in Honolulu, and then go back to the airport to hop a flight to LA or San Francisco, as long as he avoided the MPs who were on the lookout in the airport for just such subterfuge. It was another reason to grow your hair out in the boonies, as Santinella had apparently done. A guy in civvies at the airport in Honolulu could easily be spotted by the MPs if he had clean sidewalls and a military cut. Long hair provided cover. Bosch had done it himself twice during his time in country returning to L.A. to spend 5 days with a girlfriend in 1969, and then returning again 6 months later, even though there was no girlfriend anymore. Santinello had been killed more than 11 months into his tour of Vietnam. That meant he had gotten at least one leave, and probably two. Maybe he had snuck back to California. Beneath the clothing, Bosch found a compact cassette tape player and a camera, both in original boxes, the tape player marked with a price tag from the PX in Da Nang. Next to these were 2 neat rows of cassette cases, lined spine out on the bottom of the box. There was another carton of Lucky Strikes and another Zippo lighter, this one used and showing the Navy Corpsman chevron on the side. There was a well-worn copy of The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien, and he saw several beaded necklaces and other souvenirs bought at different places where Santinello had been posted during his Navy service. Bosch experienced a sense of deja vu as he looked through the contents. He had also read Tolkien in Vietnam. It was a popular book among combat veterans, a rich fantasy about another world that took them away from the reality of where they were and what they were doing. Bosch studied the names of the bands and performers on the plastic cassette cases, and remembered hearing the same music while in Vietnam. Hendrix, Cream, the Rolling Stones, the Moody Blues, and others. Along with that familiarity came his experience and knowledge of how things worked in Southeast Asia. The same Vietnamese girls who sold the necklaces at the White Elephant landing docks at Da Nang also sold pre-rolled joints in 10-packs that fit perfectly into cigarette packs for easy transport into the bush. If you wanted 50 joints, you bought a Coke can with a false top. Use of marijuana was widespread and open, the popular view being, what's the worst that can happen if I get caught? They send me to Vietnam? Bosch opened the carton of Lucky Strikes now and pulled out a pack. As he suspected, it contained 10 expertly rolled joints neatly wrapped in foil for freshness. He assumed each of the packs in the carton would be the same. Santinello had likely taken up a regular habit of getting high while in the service and wanted to make sure he had an ample supply to bridge his return home. It was all mildly interesting to Bosch because it drew on his own memories of his time in Vietnam, but he didn't readily see anything in the box that might lead him further toward confirming Whitney Vance's paternity of Dominic Santinello. That was his purpose here, confirmation of paternity. If he was going to report to Vance that his bloodline had ended in a helo crash in the Tainan province, then he had to make every effort to be sure he was telling the old man the truth. He repacked the cigarette carton and put it to the side. He lifted out the boxes containing the camera and the cassette recorder next, and just as he was wondering where the photos were that went with the camera, He saw at the bottom of the box was spread with a cache of black and white photos and envelopes containing strips of film negatives. The photos appeared to be well preserved, because they had not been exposed to light in decades. He removed the two rows of cassette tapes next, so he would be able to access the photos. He wondered if Santinello had purposely tried to hide them from his family in case they opened the box before he arrived home. Bosch pushed them into a single stack and then brought them out of the box. There were 42 photos in all, and they ran the gamut of Vietnam experiences. There were shots from the bush, shots of Vietnamese girls at the White Elephant, shots taken on the hospital ship Bosch recognized as a sanctuary, and ironically, shots taken from helicopters flying over the bush and the seemingly endless grids of rice paddies. Bosch had pushed the stack together in an order that was neither chronological nor thematic. It was a hodgepodge of images that again felt all too familiar. But those misty feelings crystallized into a hard memory when he came across three consecutive shots of the upper deck of the sanctuary, crowded with a couple hundred wounded servicemen for a Christmas Eve show, featuring Bob Hope and Connie Stevens. In the first photograph, the two performers stood side by side, Stevens' mouth open in song, the faces of the soldiers in the front row in rapt attention. The second photo focused on the crowd at the point of the bow, Monkey Mountain seen in the distance across the water. The third photo showed Hope waving goodbye to a standing ovation at the end of the show. Bosch had been there, wounded by a bamboo spear in a tunnel. He had been treated on the sanctuary for 4 weeks in December 1969. The wound itself had healed quickly, but the infection it had brought into his body had been more resistant. He'd lost 20 pounds off his already lean frame during treatment on the hospital ship, but by the last week of the month, he had recovered his health enough to receive return-to-duty orders for the day after Christmas. Hope and his troop had been scheduled for weeks, and Bosch, like everybody else on board, had been looking forward to seeing the legendary entertainer and his featured guest, Stevens, a well-known actress and singer Bosch recognized from appearances on the television shows Hawaiian Eye and 77 Sunset Strip. But on Christmas Eve, high winds and heavy seas swept across the South China Sea and were having their way with the ship. The men on board started to gather on the upper deck when four helicopters carrying Hope, his entertainers, and the band that would back them approached the fantail. But as the choppers got close, it was determined that landing on the unstable ship was too risky. The sanctuary had been built before helicopters had even been invented. A small landing pad built on the fantail looked like a moving postage stamp from the air. The men watched as the helicopters turned and headed back toward Da Nang. A communal groan moved through the crowd. The men slowly started moving off deck and back to their berths when someone looked back toward Da Nang and yelled, "Wait, they're coming back!" He was only partially right. One of the four helicopters had turned again and was coming back to the sanctuary. Its pilot made landing after three tense attempts, and out of the sliding door climbed Bob Hope, along with Connie Stevens, Neil Armstrong, and a jazz saxophonist named Quentin McKenzie. The roar that went up from the crowd returning to the deck could put an electric surge down Bosch's spine when he thought about it almost 50 years later. They had no backup band and no backup singers, but Hope and Company had told the pilot to turn that slick around and land it. Hell, Neil Armstrong had landed on the fucking moon 5 months earlier. How hard could it be to put a chopper down on a boat? Armstrong offered words of encouragement to the troops, and McKenzie laid down some solo licks on his axe. Hope told his one-liners, and Stevens sang a cappella, Breaking Hearts, with a slow rendition of the Judy Collins hit Both Sides Now. Bosch remembered it as one of his best days as a soldier. Years later, as an LAPD detective, Bosch was called upon to provide plainclothes security at the Schubert Theater for the West Coast premiere of the musical called Mamma Mia. A huge VIP turnout was expected, and the LAPD was asked to supplement the theater's own security. Standing in the front lobby, his eyes moving across faces and hands, Bosch suddenly saw Connie Stevens among the VIPs. Like a stalker, he moved through the crowd toward her. He took his badge off his belt and palmed it in case he needed it to cut through and get closer. But he got to her without issue. And when there was a pause in her conversation, he said, "Miss Stevens?" She looked at him, and he tried to tell the story, that he was there the day on the sanctuary when she and Bob Hope and the others had made the pilot turn that helicopter around. He wanted to tell her what it had meant then, and now, but something caught in his throat, and words were difficult. All he could manage to say was, "Christmas Eve, 1969, hospital ship." She looked at him for a moment, and understood, then just pulled him into a hug. She whispered into his ear, "The sanctuary. You made it home." Bosch nodded, and they separated. Without thinking, he put his badge into her hand. He then moved away, back into the crowd to do his job. He caught several weeks of hell from other detectives at Hollywood Division after he reported losing his badge, but he remembered seeing Connie Stevens at the Schubert as one of his best days as a cop. "Still doing all right up there?" Bosch came out of the memory, his eyes still on the photograph of the crowd on the sanctuary's upper deck. "Yes," he called out. "Almost done." He went back to studying the photo. He knew he was in the crowd somewhere, but he couldn't find his own face. He looked through all of Santanella's photos once more, knowing that Dominic was in none of them because he had been behind the camera. Finally, Bosch held and studied one photo that was a time-lapse shot, showing the silhouette of Monkey Mountain lit from behind by white phosphorus flares during a night battle. He remembered on the sanctuary how people would line up on the deck to watch the light show when the communication hub on top of the mountain was frequently attacked. Bosch's conclusion was that Santanello had been a talented photographer and maybe would have had a professional career at it had he survived the war. Harry could have looked at the photos all day, but he put them aside now to finish his search of the dead soldier's belongings. He next opened the red box containing Santanello's camera. It was a Leica M4, a compact camera that could have fit in one of the thigh pockets of his fatigues. It had a black body to make it less reflective when he was out in the bush. Bosch checked the rest of the box, and there was only an instruction manual. Bosch knew Leicas were expensive cameras, so he assumed that Santanello was serious about his photography. Yet there weren't many printed photos in the box. He checked the envelopes containing the negative strips and determined that there were far more frames of developed film than there were prints. He figured Santanello must not have had the money or access to print out all of his work while in Vietnam. He probably planned to do that when he got back home to the States. The last thing Bosch did was open the back of the camera to see if Santanello had used the interior space to smuggle more drugs. Instead, he found a coil of film around the take-up spool. At first he thought he had opened the camera on unexposed film, but as he unfurled the coil, he realized it was a strip of developed negatives that had been rolled up and then secreted in the camera. The strip was brittle, and it cracked and broke apart in his hands as he attempted to unfurl it and look at the images. He held one piece of three shots up to the flashlight beam. He saw that each shot was a photo of a woman with what looked like a mountain behind her, and she was holding a baby. Chapter 16. Bosch drove out to Burbank in the morning and into a commercial industrial area near the airport and the Valhalla Memorial Park. A couple blocks from the cemetery, he pulled into the lot in front of Flashpoint Graphics. He had called ahead and was expected. Flashpoint was a sprawling business that created large-scale photo illustrations for billboards, buildings, buses, and all other advertising media. On any day, its fine work could be seen across a spectrum of locations in Los Angeles and beyond. There wasn't an angle anywhere on the Sunset Strip that didn't include a Flashpoint creation, and it was all run by a man named Guy Cloudy, who in an earlier life had been a forensic photographer for the LAPD. Bosch and Cloudy had worked a number of crime scenes together in the 80s and 90s before Cloudy left to open his own photography and graphics business. The two had stayed in touch over the years, usually taking in a Dodgers game or two each season, and when Bosch called him that morning to ask a favor, Cloudy said he should come on over. Dressed casually in jeans and a Tommy Bahama shirt, Cloudy met Bosch in a nondescript reception area. Flashpoint didn't rely on walk-in business, and led him back to a more opulent but not over-the-top office where the walls were hung with framed photographs from the Dodgers' glory years. Bosch knew without asking that Cloudy had taken the photos during a short stint as team photographer. One showed the pitcher, Fernando Valenzuela, exulting from the mound. The glasses he wore allowed Bosch to place the shot toward the end of the storied pitcher's career. He pointed at the frame. "The no-hitter," he said. "The Cardinals, 1990.
"Yep," Cloudy said. "Good memory."
"I remember I was on a surveillance in Echo Park, up on White Knoll. It was me and Frankie Sheehan. You remember the Dollmaker case?"
"Of course. You got the guy."
"Yeah, well, that night we were watching a different guy up on White Knoll, and we could see the stadium from there, and we listened to Vinny call the no-hitter. We could hear the broadcast coming out of all the open windows of the houses. I wanted to bail out on the surveillance and go over for the last inning. You know, badger our way into the stadium and watch. But we stayed put and listened to Vinny. I remember it ended on a double play."
"Yep, and I wasn't expecting that. Guerrero hitting into a double. I almost didn't get the shot because I was reloading. And man, what are we going to do now without Vinny?"
It was a reference to the retirement of Vin Scully, the Dodgers' venerable announcer, who had called the team's games since 1950, an incredibly long record going all the way back to when they were the Brooklyn Dodgers.
"I don't know," Bosch said. "He might have started in Brooklyn, but he's the voice of this city. It won't be the same without him."
They somberly sat down on either side of a desk, and Bosch tried to change the subject.
"So this is a big place you've got here," he said, thoroughly impressed by how large his friend's business was. "I had no idea."
40,000 square feet. That's the size of a Best Buy," Cloudy said. "And we need more room. But you know what? I still miss the crime stuff."
"Tell me you have some crime stuff for me to do."
Bosch smiled. "Well, I've got a mystery, but I don't think there's any crime involved."
"Mystery is good. I'll take mystery. What have you got?"
Bosch handed him the envelope he had carried in from the car. It contained the negatives that included the shot of the woman and the baby. He had shown them to Olivia McDonald, but she had no idea who the woman or child was. Just as intrigued as Harry, she had allowed him to take the envelope along with the toiletries kit.
"I'm on a private case," Bosch said, "and I found these negatives. They're almost 50 years old, and they've been in an attic without air conditioning or heat. On top of that, they're damaged. They cracked and broke apart in my hand when I found them. I want to know what you can do with them."
Cloudy opened the envelope and poured its contents out onto his desk. He leaned over and looked straight down at the broken pieces of the negative strip without touching them.
"Some of them look like they show a woman in front of a mountaintop," Bosch said. "I'm interested in all of it, but in those the most. The woman? I think the location is someplace in Vietnam."
"Yeah, you have some cupping here, some cracking.
It's Fujifilm."
"Meaning what?"
"It usually holds up pretty well."
"Who is she?"
"I don't know. That's why I want to see her, and the baby she's holding."
Cloudy said, "Okay. I think I can do something with this. My guy's in the lab can. We'll rewash and re-dry them, then we'll print. I see some fingerprints, and they might be set after so long." Bosch considered that. His assumption was that Santinello took the shots. They were with his camera and other negatives taken by him. Why would someone send developed negatives to a soldier in Vietnam? But if it was ever questioned, the fingerprints might be useful.
"What's your time frame?" Cloudy asked.
"Yesterday," Bosch said.
Cloudy smiled.
"Of course," he said.
"You're hurry up, Harry."
Bosch smiled back and nodded. Nobody had called him that since Cloudy had left the department.
"So give me an hour," Cloudy said. "You can go to our break room and make an espresso."
"I hate those things," Bosch replied.
"Okay, then go take a walk in the cemetery. More your style anyway."
"1 hour."
"1 hour."
Bosch stood up.
"Give my regards to Oliver Hardy," Cloudy said.
"He's in there."
"Will do," Bosch said.
Bosch left Flashpoint and walked down Valhalla Drive. It was only when he entered the cemetery by a huge memorial that he remembered that in his research of Whitney Vance, he had read that Vance's father was buried here. Close to Caltech, and under the jet path of Bob Hope Airport, the cemetery was the final resting place for a variety of aviation pioneers, designers, pilots, and barnstormers. They were interred or memorialized in and around a tall domed structure called the Portal of the Folded Wing Shrine to Aviation. Bosch found Nelson Vance's memorial plaque on the tiled floor of the shrine. Nelson Vance, visionary air pioneer, earliest advocate of U.S. air power, whose prophetic vision and leadership was a primary factor in American supremacy in the air, in war and peace. Bosch noticed that there was a space next to the memorial plaque for another internment and wondered if this was already on reserve as Whitney Vance's final destination. Bosch wandered out of the shrine and over to the memorial to the astronauts lost in two separate space shuttle disasters. He then looked across one of the green lawns and saw the start of a burial service near one of the big fountains. He decided not to venture further into the cemetery, a tourist amid the grief, and headed back to Flashpoint without searching for the grave of the heavier half of the comedy team of Laurel and Hardy. Cloudy was ready for him when Bosch returned. He was ushered into a drying room in the lab, where 9 8x10 black-and-white prints were clipped to a plastic board. The photos were still wet with developing fluids, and a lab tech was just finishing using a squeegee to remove the excess. The exterior framing was seen on some of the prints, and some showed the fingerprints Cloudy had warned about. Some of the shots were completely blown out by light exposure, and others exhibited varying degrees of damage to the negative. But there were three shots that were at least 90% intact, and one of these was a shot of the woman and child. The first thing Bosch realized was that he had been wrong about the woman standing in front of a mountain in Vietnam. It was no mountainside, and it was not Vietnam. It was the recognizable roofline of the Hotel Del Coronado down near San Diego. Once Bosch registered the location, he moved in close to study the woman and the baby. The woman was Latina, and Bosch could see a ribbon in the baby's hair. A girl, no more than a month or two old. The woman's mouth was open in a smile showing unbridled happiness. Bosch studied her eyes and the happy light that was in them. There was love in those eyes. For the baby. For the person behind the camera. The other photos were full frames and fragments from a series of shots taken on the beach behind the Del Coronado. Shots of the woman. Shots of the baby. Shots of the sparkling waves. "Does it help?" Cloudy asked. He was standing behind Bosch, not getting in the way as Harry studied the prints. "I think so," Bosch said. "Yeah." He considered the totality of the circumstances. The photos and their subjects were important enough to Dominic Santinello for him to attempt to hide them as he sent his property home from Vietnam. The question was why. Was this his child? Did he have a secret family that his family in Oxnard knew nothing about? If so, why the secrecy? He looked closely at the woman in the photo. She seemed to be in her mid to late 20s. Dominic would not yet have been 20. Was the relationship with an older woman the reason he didn't tell his parents and sister? Another question was about the location. The photos were taken during a trip to the beach, either at or near the Hotel Del Coronado. When was this? And why was a strip of negatives from a photo shoot that very clearly took place in the States included in property sent home from Vietnam? Bosch scanned the images again, looking for anything that would help place the shots in time. He saw nothing. "For what it's worth, the guy was good," Cloudy said. "Had a good eye." Bosch agreed. "Is he dead?" Cloudy asked. "Yes," Bosch said. "Never made it home from Vietnam." "That's too bad." "Yeah, I saw some of his other work from the bush, from his missions. I'd love to see it. Maybe there's something that could be done with it." Bosch nodded, but was concentrating on the photos in front of him. "You can't tell when these photos were taken, can you?" he asked. "No, there was no time stamp on the film," Cloudy said. "Not really done back then." Bosch expected that to be the case. "But what I can tell you is when the film was made," Cloudy added. "Down to a 3-month period. Fuji coded their film stock by production cycle." Bosch turned around and looked at Cloudy. "Show me." Cloudy came forward and went to one of the prints made from a broken negative. The negative's frame was part of the print. Cloudy pointed to a series of letters and numbers in the frame. "They marked the film by year and 3-month manufacturing run. You see here?
This is it.
He pointed to a section of the coding. 70-AJ. This film was made between April and June of 1970, he said.
Boss considered the information. But it could have been used